Okay, so obviously I don't want to repeat all of the wonderful things that people have said about Gary. Suffice to say, it just genuinely is true that Gary is a tremendously nice and generous person, and there aren't, in my personal experience, that's a small subset of people, and he's also a very brilliant physicist. That's a small subset of people, and so he's a rather unique point in the set of all people. I've never been his student and I've never been his postdoc, but I've had many interactions with Gary over the years, and I think it's Gary probably doesn't realize how much influence that has on young people coming into a field where it's often quite intimidating. And I've been tremendously influenced by Gary's work, but also just the fact he's taken the time to interact and shown interest and so on is tremendously motivating. And you probably don't appreciate how much effect that has. So thank you very much, Gary. I'm going to talk today about some work that we're just finishing off. This is myself and a student, Andrew Hickling, a very good student at Imperial. And I chose to speak about this because it fits very much into Gary's sort of program of using geometry to say things about physics. And hopefully there'll be more to say along these lines. So what I want to talk about is how maybe to understand sort of very general features of confinement in the context of ADS-CFT. Thank you. Let's see. Can you hear? Good. So the plan for the talk is I want to give you a quick review of some basics of ADS-CFT. We've already heard quite a lot about it, so I don't want to dwell on it. I'm just going to stress the important aspects, and in particular, I'm going to use the fact that it allows us to study quantum field theory, or specifically certain conformal theories, or certain properties of certain conformal theories, on curved space-time in a very elegant way. And these are strongly coupled theories, and that's an environment where, if you think about the strongly coupled theory from first principle, it's extremely difficult to study or make general statements on curved space-time. And in particular, from the ADS-CFT point of view, what I want to focus on is the situation where this curved space-time is such that you've introduced a length scale. Conformal field theory has no length scale a priori, but if you put it on a curved space, you introduce a length scale, and you may then be in a situation where the theory develops an energy gap. And often, these theories typically, as we understand them, are gauge theories, and that energy gap would be associated with confinement. And there are certain generic features you would expect on the gravitational side, so a gap in the spectrum of fluctuations, but also a type of black hole called a small black hole, analogous to what we have in global ADS from the work of Hawking and Page. And so I want to discuss some very general properties that these two sort of natural observables, they're related to natural quantities and field theory, sort of bounds that those experience just from the fact that they're related to some bulk geometry.
I suppose that's a question. Can I do it? I'm not sure. This is, again, a problem in geometry. So
I think it's pointing towards me. Right. So as a sort of motivating question we can ask, supposing we put some conformal field theory, maybe hopefully strongly coupled. If it's weakly coupled, obviously we can say very simple things about it. But if it's a strongly coupled theory on some arbitrary space, we want to normalize the scale of the space, so maybe we fix its volume or its curvature. We might ask, is there a gap in the spectrum, and what's the smallest gap? And maybe what space do we have to put the field theory on to minimize that gap? Or maximize it, or what statements can we make? A sort of trivial example would be if we took a conformal scalar. Here we have to have a conformal coupling to the scalar, the curvature scalar of the metric that we put the theory on, and then there'll be some spectrum of modes, and trivially you can show that this
this curvature term acts like a mass, and so that provides some bound. The minimum scalar sort of gives you a minimum effective mass in some sense, so that there's immediately a bound involving the minimum of this Ricci scalar and the minimum frequency of oscillation. So for example, in this example, you can see if you were to normalize your space by requiring this minimum curvature to be a positive and say one in your units, then a sphere would minimize, would saturate this bound. So what happens when we go to strongly coupled theory? Well, we're going to use the tool of ADS-CFT. Again, I won't say too much about the details of it. Obviously, Juan is here and taught us this. Certain conformal field theories, somewhat special ones, are dual to certain gravitational theories. They're characterized by some number of degrees of freedom, which we have to take to be large to get gravitational control so that it behaves semi-classically. And then one thing that's interesting is, however, that gravitational theory you land up with may be rather complicated. There may be all sorts of other fields. There may be, typically you're interested in asymptotics that have some ADS factor, but may have some other complicated space associated to it. But one can always go to a, one can always consistently truncate to a dynamics that's just described for a D-dimensional CFT by a D plus one dimensional Einstein condition. So we can throw away all the other matter fields and just focus. It's consistent, at least in the large number of fields limit, or large number of degrees of freedom limit, to focus on this much simpler sector and to maybe make some statements that are just universal to any theory that has such a correspondence. And so we're really then interested in this universal sector of just looking at the Einstein condition. And this condition, it's very analogous in the Riemannian context to an asymptotically locally hyperbolic condition, but we want, in the space-time, it's asymptotically locally ADS. And we have to fix the boundary metric. We have to fix the data that lives at the conformal boundary. And that data, the conformal class of the conformal boundary, is the data that specifies what metric the theory, the CFT, lives on. So it's a very beautiful, I mean, it's a wonderfully beautiful correspondence, really, geometrically. And so it's a very powerful tool, as I said. It geometrizes strongly coupled quantum field theory problems. And so maybe we can use geometric techniques to make general statements about certain quantum field theories and learn things. And that's really the direction of the talk. And of course, we do have other techniques to analyze strongly coupled field theories, but in cases where the boundary conditions are such that you generate time dependence or spatial dependence, those techniques are practically very difficult to implement. So this provides a nice tool in sort of simple settings, but once you have time dependence or spatial dependence, there really aren't ab initio methods to take your strongly coupled field theory and solve it. So it's a tremendously powerful tool in this sort of setting. And in fact, with Don and Mukund, we wrote a sort of review of some properties of ADS-CFT on various curved spacetimes. And so again, this talk will be along those lines. So how does confinement emerge in ADS-CFT? Of course, confinement is very important because if we're interested in QCD, we want to be somewhat more realistic and want to modify our ADS-CFT so that we have some confinement scale. So there's been a lot of consideration of how to introduce confinement. And certainly the sort of most elegant way to do it is to put the CFT on some sort of curved space. You introduce a scale, that can introduce a mass gap and the other properties associated with confinement in a gauge theory. And the simplest setting is global ADS, as pointed out by Witten many years ago. So we take global ADS, the conformal boundary is time cross a sphere with some radius r, that's the scale that then is going to set the gap and confinement physics. One of the features now of this geometry is that supposing we consider some scalar field fluctuating on that fixed geometry, we'll ignore its back reaction, assume it's just small fluctuations, that field from the dual field theory point of view will correspond to some operator. The mass of the field in the bulk is related to the scaling dimension of the operator. There's some explicit relation And I'm always going to consider, for those who know about this, the sort of usual quantization of the bulk scalar, so there's some condition on delta, although the mass squared, as we know, can be negative as long as it obeys the Brighton-Loden-Friedman bound. So there's this scalar fluctuations which has some interpretation in the terms of the spectrum of the conformal field theory. Because the bulk is static, we can decompose scalar fluctuations in the bulk in harmonics in time, and we can talk about the spectrum of these frequencies. And for global ADS, you can just solve that spectrum, and in particular, it's discrete. There's a gap that corresponds to the mass gap in the theory, at least in this case associated to some scalar operators. And the mass gap, you can write it very explicitly in terms of the dimension of the dual operator and the size of the sphere, as you would expect. But another signature, perhaps that's less obvious, but is associated to the confinement, is this behavior that Hawking and Page observed many years ago. Again, they looked at global ADS Schwarzschild. It's a one-parameter family of static black holes like Schwarzschild. But it's somewhat more complicated because now you have a scale given by the ADS scale. The large mass or energy solutions have large temperature. They have positive specific heat and have a universal behavior. When you're at very high temperature, of course, your field theory shouldn't care about what space it lives on. It's really just probing local physics. And this is really a manifestation of the fluid gravity correspondence of our organizers and others. And so the large mass limit looks very different to the usual flat space Schwarzschild behavior. It has some very specific behavior, which really doesn't care about the fact that the details of the space you're on at all. However, there's a small black hole which looks when the masses are very small, energies are small, temperatures again are high. So these solutions have negative specific heat and look very much like flat space Schwarzschild solutions because the radius of the horizon is very small compared to the ADS length. And this is one parameter family of solutions going from sort of high temperature to high temperature, positive specific heat, negative specific heat. And so there's some minimum temperature in between, which is associated again to the fact that there's a, in this theory, there's a first order confinement, deconfinement phase transition in the gauge theory. So that's not, so there's physics in the fact that there are these small black holes and large black holes which have rather different behaviors. Okay. There's another confining dual, which I mentioned because it's interesting and it's been used, these sort of ideas have been used to build phenomenological models, but of course it's due to Gary, as so many of these ideas sort of originate in Gary's work. It's called the ADS soliton, so it's due to a paper by Gary and Rob, and it's related to the ADS Schwarzschild solution with planar sections, but is, as we heard, a double wick rotation. So it's one of Gary's specialities of taking known solutions, doing some clever stuff, and coming up with some interesting physics. So in fact, I sort of, I think it's no coincidence that Gary has settled in the west of the US. Obviously appropriately fits. So, as I said, there's a double wick rotation. To get this metric, you wick rotate time and a circle. So it's related to the usual Schwarzschild black hole by this double wick rotation. So what it corresponds in the field theory to is the vacuum geometry associated to putting the field theory on time across a torus and a circle. And the size of the circle, let's call it L, then is related to the Schwarzschild parameter in the bulk, and you have to, that Schwarzschild parameter is related so that this geometry is perfectly smooth, but is introduced to scale, and if you analyze things, there's a gap in terms of spectrum of fluctuations, and also this, it's believed, although that there's been some numerical work in not quite the situation, but I think it's reasonable to believe there are small black holes which have a Schwarzschild-like behavior, and there's the universal large black holes, and there's some sort of Hawking-Page transition between them. Okay, so what happens in general? Supposing we take a completely general metric to put the field theory on, can we say anything without sitting down and working out the details? What can we say? So
Let's consider our CFT to be living on some space sigma across time. So let's call the metric on sigma h bar. Let's assume that the bulk is static. We're interested in vacuum solutions. So we'll assume the bulk is static, and we'll write it in terms of a sort of vibration over some base, which is Riemannian. Let's call it M, and it's got a metric H. And then there's some, basically the Laplace function, I'll write as 1 over Z, and I'll also pull, you know, I'll write it in this conformal form, so some people would call H the optical metric of the bulk. Let me just call it the base. And this particular form has some advantages, as we'll see later. So we can think of Z as a sort of redshift in the bulk. It's a function, because this is all static, really everything is, can be thought about as a problem on M. So Z is a function on M. It vanishes. M has to have a boundary that will correspond in the spacetime to the conformal boundary of the space. And Z should vanish on that conformal boundary. And then the geometry of, as I said, the field theory that the geometry that the CFT lives on, sigma, is just the boundary of M and a conformal representative for the metric it lives on is given by H bar, and then it's that metric, okay? And note one advantage of this is d by dt in the bulk continues, you know, smoothly extends to d by dt in the boundary. So if we wanted a picture, we can think of you know, this solid cylinder, the interior is the interior of this space. There's an asymptotic local ADS near the surface of the cylinder. A slice through in time gives us M with its metric H, and the boundary of that slice is the spatial section of the spacetime that the field theory lives on. So we can write the Bolk-Einstein equations covariantly over M. I have to say, I have no comments on Gary's spelling. I haven't written a paper with him. I wrote a review article with him in his book. But my spelling is sufficiently bad that I have no idea whether other people's spellings are correct. But I do know, having spent quite a lot of time thinking about trying to solve the Einstein equations, there are lots of them. And that's, to my mind, one of the issues. And so I rather like the S. Anyway, there we are. So we'll think of the Einstein equations written covariantly over this base. Again, if we think about some fluctuations of some scalar about the vacuum geometry described by a solution of this, we can reduce that to an eigenvalue problem on the base, as you would normally, with some frequency omega. Now, we have to make some assumptions here to say anything. So what are we going to make? So we're going to assume that the bulk solution firstly exists, given this boundary metric. We're going to assume it's smooth because it's likely, you know, assuming there is some smooth solution, that's going to be the one that dominates the partition function probably. Although, of course, we don't have good control over what singularities are available, but let's assume it's smooth. Let's assume that d by dt is globally time-like, so z only vanishes at the boundary, so there are no horizons in the bulk. So, for example, Poincaré ADS wouldn't be an example of this. We're going to assume that this base has finite volume and doesn't have any other boundaries or asymptotic regions than the conformal boundary, okay? And we're also going to assume that it's closed, so it's compact without boundaries, such as the sphere or torus cross the circle and so on, okay? And so these examples we came across earlier are certainly examples of this case. So there's a general question, given sigma, can you expect bulks that satisfy these equations, these conditions? And I don't really have very much to say, but I think that's an interesting, you know, from a relativist point of view, that's an interesting problem to address. Mike Anderson, I think, has results in these directions, but I think generally there are no general statements. But let's assume that. Can we then make any statements about the CFT behavior? So we can analyze the behavior near the boundary, and one of the things we learn is that the boundary metric and its Ricci tensor are related to the values of the base metric and Ricci tensor at the boundary. So there's a simple relation between the Ricci scalar of the base evaluated at the boundary and the boundary, or field theory, Ricci scalar. Okay. You can also analyze how the scalar fluctuations, we have a Dirichlet condition on the scalar, so its sort of leading fall off is constrained to be zero, and then they fall off in as you might imagine, like z to the delta, and this is the usual sort of way scalars behave. And a very important tool that we can use is that this base Ricci scalar obeys a nice condition. It obeys, you can, just by direct computation, you can show that this, the Laplacian, the base Laplacian on the Ricci scalar is negative at an extremum. So you have a maximum, or rather a minimum principle, that says there can't be minima of this Ricci scalar in the interior of the solution. And so that allows you to control, in particular, the minimum value this Ricci scalar can take anywhere in the interior of the solution in terms of its minimum value on the boundary. Okay? So obviously you know what metric you put the CFT on, so you know what R min is in principle, and that's then quite a powerful constraint on the bulk geometry. So the question is, you know, is this an is this quantity then, does it play any role in the physics? Because maybe you can then say something. Okay, so let's think about this redshift function z. It's very physical because it relates the local time in the bulk at some position to the time in the field theory in our conformal frame. Z will have some extrema. It vanishes on the boundary. It's positive in the interior, so it must have some maximum. But it will have other extrema in general, or we don't have an argument to say that it can't. Maybe there's some argument that it can't. But one of the things the equations directly give you is that the value of z at the extremal points is just simply related to the value of this Ricci scalar of the base at the extremal points. Okay. So for example, here's some z plotted over this base as a function. This might look like global ADS. It's just got one maximum, but you might have sort of exotic boundary metrics with multiple extrema. But as I say, the value of z is simply related to this Ricci scalar. So let's talk about small black holes. If we think about a geodesic, a time-like geodesic, we can think of reducing the geodesic conditions to some motion on this base, and then it obeys some sort of forced geodesic equation on this base, M, governed by a potential given by Z. So that's not very, that's what you would expect. Z is like a Newtonian potential, and in some sense, the particle is moving in the Newtonian potential. So at the extrema of z, you can put a particle, and it'll just sit there. It may not be stable, but it will certainly sit there. Okay. So what we'd expect is that we can patch in very small black holes at these extremal points. And so these will be the analog of the very small black hole in global ADS, but we might have several of them if we've got multiple extremal points. I don't have a rigorous argument. You could possibly talk about matched asymptotic expansions, but I think it's fairly clear there's, well, it seems that there's no obvious obstruction to doing this, to pasting in a small black hole, and so we, presumably there are static solutions associated to these. So as I said, if you've got multiple extrema of Z, presumably there are multiple black holes, although some of them will be unstable to falling off that point. And we can then say what the behavior, the thermodynamic behavior of these small black holes looks like from the point of view of the CFT. It's describing some states in the CFT. When we're very near this very small black hole, it looks like some Schwarzschild solution in flat space, so we know very well in terms of a radius how the entropy and mass of that solution go. The entropy locally viewed near this little black hole is just going to be the entropy in the field theory associated to the states that it's describing. But the mass locally gets redshifted when you view it from the boundary. So the CFT entropy is this local entropy. The CFT energy is this mass multiplied by the ADS length over this redshift function evaluated at where the black hole is sitting. And so we have this, we get this relation. A is just some dimensionless number, depending on dimension. S tilde and E tilde are the entropy and energy divided by the effective numbers of degrees of freedom. So you have some simple relation here for this behavior of these small black holes, which is describing some states, given in terms, the only data we don't know is this redshift function at these points. But that immediately tells us, That we can re-express that condition instead of in terms of the redshift function, we can express it in terms of the Ricci scalar at these points, because there's a simple relation. And we have this bound, so we can bound this from above and below by the value of the Ricci scalar, because we know it's got maxima and minima, we know the interior was smooth, that was an assumption, and we know the minimum value is bounded because of this minimum principle in terms of the value of the Ricci scalar, the minimum value at the boundary. So the upper bound is sort of, you know, it's curious, it's telling you something about behavior of states and it's giving some bound about how the bulk geometry, how much curvature it has to carry. But the lower bound, I think, is interesting because it involves only quantities that are field theory data. So the energy, the entropy of the field theory, and the curvature, the minimum Ricci scalar of the space it's defined on. So this seems to be a bound that these black holes must satisfy, independent of the actual nature of the bulk solution. We don't know what the actual solution is, but provided it satisfies these conditions that it has no other boundaries and it's smooth, it has to obey this bound. And this bound is also nice. If you think about global ADS in this way, I've written the interior. One nice property about it is that the bulk, the Ricci scalar of this base is just constant. It's actually very simple. And because of that, you can see that these bounds must be sharp. So this bound here, in terms of the energy and entropy of these states, in terms of the curvature of the boundary, is saturated for global ADS. One could do similar things for the scalar fluctuations. So if we put a scalar fluctuating without back reaction about this vacuum geometry, if you write the wave function of the scalar in terms of some bounded function J with the sort of correct asymptotic falloff, you can massage the eigenvalue problem for J into this form using the Einstein equations to, you know, in particular to get this term and this term, you've used them. And then using the usual eigenvalue analysis, you multiply by J, integrate over the base. You can ignore the surface terms because of the Brighton load of because of this condition here, and you get the some relation for the frequency. This immediately gives you a lower bound on the frequency, and you can get an upper bound by considering a variational principle, where you have to supply some trial wave function J. If you, for a given trial wave function, you'll get a bound, an upper bound on the frequency, and in fact, J is constant. Gives you an upper bound, that's a trial wave function that's nice, and then you get these bounds here. And again, the lower bound, so this looks very similar to what we had before, this lower bound involves our min, the minimum value of the Ricci scalar in the bulk, but can be related to the boundary Ricci scalar value, and again, these bounds must be sharp, because for global ADS, R is just constant. Okay, so these bounds are sharp and satisfied for global ADS. So, I don't know how I'm doing for time, but let me summarize. So, we've considered the certain classes of CFTs, and certain dynamical subsectors of these CFTs on some space sigma. We've assumed it's closed, and such spaces can have confining behavior. So, we've assumed this has some holographic description, and we've made some assumptions about the nature of the bulk. So obviously a big assumption, but given that assumption, we don't need to know anything about the nature of the bulk itself to derive some bounds on scalar fluctuations. Presumably, one could do a similar thing for graviton fluctuations. We haven't done that yet. It's slightly more complicated, but I guess one should expect that as well. And the behavior of small black holes. Remember, very large black holes are universal behavior, so these are the very small black holes. Okay. This obviously, as I emphasized, doesn't involve knowing the nature of the bulk solution itself. So these are rather general bounds, and probably if you're cleverer than me and know more maths and geometry, there may be all sorts of other things you could say. There may be more powerful bounds. I think there's a lot to explore in principle. You know, this idea that you've geometrized your QFT problem, there are lots of techniques in geometry that you then may be able to make powerful statements with. So these are just some examples. I'm not saying these are the end of the story at all. We've made these assumptions about the nature of the bulk. of course, whether given a sigma those assumptions are true or not is then an interesting question, but it seems reasonable that if those assumptions don't hold, it's probable you don't have this gapped behavior, or it's not obvious you would have it. So for example, if you have an extremal horizon in the bulk, as for example for Poincaré ADS, you wouldn't expect to have a gapped behavior. And so I suppose, coming back to the original question, given some sigma normalized by R min, the minimum value of the Ritchie scale you put the theory on, we can say, at least for the fluctuations in the dynamics that are associated to some scalar operator, we can say that indeed a sphere minimizes the gap in the case that the CFT is a holographic one. But again, I want to emphasize, the idea is just using simple geometry, there may be all sorts of statements about field theory we could make that, but I suppose the key is to identify the correct objects that are of interest for field theory and then be able to make geometric statements about them. So you want to make statements about quantities that really are accessible in the field theory only, rather than making statements about what's going on in the bulk. But it seems to be possible, at least with very elementary methods, so I'm sure there's more to be said. So remains to thank Gary for being just a sort of wonderful mentor and for giving us so much beautiful physics to think about.
Hey, so that was that's very nice. I had a whole bunch of questions, two. So do you know how many, maybe you said, so given a boundary geometry, do you know how many black holes there will be in the bulk, how many of these critical points there will be? So if you want to make one with a million, if I give you some manifold, do you know how many small black holes there will, want to be?
So let me, the outset, no. Let me say, obviously there's one or more. For the ADS soliton, in fact, you have a sort of flat direction. Right, so if you think about the ADS soliton, because the boundary is flat, it's sort of a degenerate case, and you can put the small black hole anywhere on the circle. Mm-hmm. So you might imagine if you did a periodic perturbation to the boundary, you could, for every period of the perturbation, you might get a sort of stable black hole and an unstable black hole. That seems potentially reasonable. Maybe it's more complicated. You might imagine, with some restrictions on the topology, you might be able to prove that there's only one maximum. I'm not sure. I just don't know. I mean, I don't know enough maths. I'm not terribly good at maths, so I'm rather limited.
I mean, so like purposes of modeling, let's say, glassiness or something, it would be very interesting to have transitions like where suddenly there wants to be a lot of very complicated black holes in the bulk disconnected horizons. That's one motivation. Is it connected, or can I ask
a second
question?
Yeah, can I give a partial answer to that
question? Yeah, please.
So you were asking about general techniques for studying these things, and I wanted to mention, I don't know to what extent it's actually in the literature, Mukun could comment, but just like for the high temperature black holes, there's a fluid gravity derivative expansion. Your problem is basically double wick rotation. And there should be a similar derivative expansion for these kinds of solitons. So in the context where your boundary geometry is roughly long and cylindrical with slow variations, and this is, by the way, is I'll mention that George and I have used this.
Yeah.
We're trying to just study some similar things. In that context, you can just see what the answer is, and if you put lots of bumps on your geometry, you get lots and lots of minima.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, it's exactly this sort of, I don't know, it's probably related to minimal surfaces in the boundary or something, the number of minima. It'd be nice to analyze that question in this context.
But again, I think it's what's interesting, I mean, I haven't thought long enough about it to think about application, but I mean, the key is to identify interesting physical questions, and they may correspond to quite basic geometric questions.
Okay.
You know, it's not, yeah.
Quickly ask my second question. So you're interested in gaps, but actually in the black hole case, so that you could think of the same setup where you allow yourself to change the boundary manifold, but now at finite temperature and black hole, and then you could ask about instabilities as a function of the boundary geometry, which is something I thought about a long time ago. And there you'd want to prove, so if you could prove that omega squared has to be negative, that's of course will be an instability of the bulk.
Yeah.
And it seemed what happened back in the day, is that it looked like the Weyl curvature was actually controlling that more than the Ritchie scalar, and that if if the boundary manifold had some vial tensor squared that was sufficiently big relative to the Ricci scalar, then you tended to get instabilities in the bulk.
That was with some homogeneity assumptions and so on. Was that right? This was your work with Gary.
Yeah, a long time ago. But it's the same setup. That you want to allow yourself some manifold on the boundary.
I see.
And then it sounds like these methods you might be able to just prove conditions under which you would necessarily get an instability in the bulk.
That's interesting.
In the black hole case.
Yes, I mean, I suppose it's worth saying. I mean, this obviously proves proves in the sense of a mode analysis rather than a more rigorous analysis. But you can argue if the boundary Ricci scalar is positive everywhere, it would prove stability. But the way the bound seems to go is it's not going to tell you about instability because it's where you have control in terms of field theory quantities, it's a lower bound. But maybe it works differently for the black holes. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, it's more of a comment, but I think you're using confinement in a somewhat unconventional sense for a gauge theorist. I mean, if I take a CFT and put it on a three-sphere, it's not a confining gauge theory.
Yes.
But that's, I mean, I don't mean to scold you. I guess this was
one of the things Witten commented on early on in, when he wrote this first paper about ADS and the soliton. I completely agree. It's to do with the Gauss constraint in some sense when you put
it seems like the global ADS may be a somewhat atypical example, right? Because what it really measures is the spectrum of operators, right? The energy spectrum on the sphere is just the spectrum of scaling dimensions. But if I take some other manifold, like for example, if I take a torus at the boundary, then you don't expect a smooth geometry in between, inside, right?
Well, that's the ADS soliton.
No. But I thought you were just taking only the dimensions of the theory, of the field theory plus one, without some extra dimensions, no? Yeah. Just taking a spatial torus and time.
But that's the ADS soliton solution.
Right.
So
you have extra dimensions that shrink smoothly. I thought in your talk you were just studying the d plus one dimensional geometry. No.
Yes. I think it's. Yes, so I mean,
it's the circles in the torus that shrink smoothly.
There are two solutions when you put the theory on a torus.
Yeah,
you were mixing up
a bit this. I mean, what I would call a confining theory is something that has a gap even when you put it on RD, right? That's what everyone calls a confining theory.
Yes, so.
But then you usually need the extra cycles that shrink, like in the ADS soliton.
The ADS soliton, again, I'm not sure. In the ADS soliton case, the way people normally talk about it is that you have this conformal theory on, say, flat space cross a circle or a torus cross a circle, and you then imagine compactifying or looking at scales much larger than the circle size, and then you say you have some effective lower dimensional theory which exhibits a gap. And people talk about that as a confining theory.
Right.
Now, that's the sense in which I'm talking about this being confining. You could take the torus as large as you like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly in this setting. So whether it's right, I mean, and as people have discussed in the literature, there's a question about you can't really do a reduction because you have these Kaluza-Klein modes which are always around the confinement scale. So whether that's a good model or not for confinement is one of the issues that I guess has been discussed a lot in the more phenomenological literature. But it's certainly within this setting, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.